So this evening, we're exploring meeting the Buddha in our imagination. I should mention I've had a cold, so my voice is a bit... So we'll see how we go. So the Buddha. He is calm like the earth that endures. He is steady like a column that is firm. He is pure like a lake that is clear. He is free from samsara, the endless round of suffering. In the light of his vision, he has found true freedom. His thoughts are peace. His words are peace. And his work is peace. By what earthly track could you lead the Buddha astray? He who can wander the pathless ways of the infinite. The Buddha who is awake, whose victory cannot be reversed. A being none can conquer. One of true vision is not easy to find. Freed from craving, hatred and delusion. A Buddha is a guide to be cherished. He is calm, like the earth that endures. He is steady, like a column that is firm. He is pure, like a lake that is clear. He is free from samsara, the endless round of suffering. In the light of his vision, he has found true freedom. His thoughts are peace. His words are peace. And his work is peace. By what earthly track could you lead the Buddha astray? He who can wander the pathless ways of the infinite. The Buddha who is awake, whose victory cannot be reversed, is a being none can conquer. One of true vision is not easy to find. Freed from craving, hatred and delusion, a Buddha is a guide to be cherished. So those words come from the Dhammapada, which is one of our earliest Buddhist texts. In an ancient language called Pali, which is as close as we can get to the language that the Buddha spoke. So it takes us back pretty close to the time of the Buddha. And for me, it's something that sort of stuck to my heart mind. It spoke to me. I didn't set out to learn it, but it sort of stuck. And it is often there in that way when I start meditating in the morning, that sense of, the Buddha. So I invite you to think, what's the Buddha like in your heart mind? Is he there in your heart mind? And if so, in what way? How do you respond to the word Buddha? There's a lovely story in the Pali Canon, and I can't remember who the character is, but he hears the word Buddha, and he goes, Buddha, Buddha, who is this Buddha? And just the name of the word Buddha sends him searching, wanting to find the Buddha. And the image, we've got this image of the Buddha. There are many images of the Buddha. How do you respond to the image of the Buddha? For me, when I started, I didn't respond to the image of the Buddha at all. I went on a retreat and I couldn't tell you anything about the shrine. I remember nothing about it whatsoever. I remember a lot of other things about the retreat, but actually the Buddha wasn't the main way that I connected to start with. It was something that evolved over time. And we can have a range of responses to the Buddha. It's not possible to have a wrong response. Whatever our response is, that's what our response is, and there's energy in that. There's energy that we can be curious about, that we can explore. We might feel challenged, we might feel aversion. It might seem, yeah, what the Buddha says is common sense. It's really human common sense. Might be a strong sense of fascination. Might leave you with a lot of questions or puzzlement. There's no right or wrong answer. But it is very important to be honest about our authentic response to the Buddha. Where are we starting from? We start from there. And I'm going to say more about that shortly. But before I do that, you will notice that you all have a small piece of yellow paper, the colour of the Buddha, and you all have a pen. And I'm just going to invite you for just a couple of minutes to jot down how you respond to the word or the image or the idea of the Buddha. It might be thoughts, it might be feelings, it might be images, you might have questions. Any responses that you've got, don't overthink it. There's no way, it's not possible to do this wrong. And the other thing that you need to know is whatever you write down, you don't ever have to show it to anybody else, ever, unless you want to. This is between you and the bit of paper. I'm just inviting you to make conscious what's your response to the Buddha. So we'll just take a couple of minutes, and then I'll ring a bell and I'll power in. So if your piece of paper is blank, don't worry. It means there's space. It means there's space in which nothing has happened yet. And I also want to invite you, for the rest of the evening, if I say something that calls to you, or something that sparks your imagination, your interest, or perhaps seems like a seed, just feel free to write it down. It's always good to notice those things. Always good to notice. Our friend Manjushvara, who was a poet, who died about 8 years ago, wrote a haiku about the Buddha. And he wrote, "Something called to him, repeated over and over, and he noticed. Something called to him, repeated over and over, and he noticed." So a lot of it is about noticing what our heart mind responds to. And indeed, you can carry on doing that for the rest of your life, not just this evening. Some people carry around little notebooks so that they can hear the voices that speak. I don't mean literally like hearing voices, but just if something speaks, captures your interest, your imagination, has that taste of freedom that characterises the Buddha's teachings, it's really good to notice and pay attention. So, how can we meet the Buddha? Well, the Buddha, the historical Buddha, lived 2,500 years ago. So we can't meet his physical presence. But the Buddha wasn't just a historical presence. He also exists on an archetypal level. He's the living embodiment of the Dharma. So he's embodiment of wisdom, compassion, faith, energy. Enlightenment's very much about energy as well. Mindfulness, awakening, utter and complete freedom. As I say, the taste of freedom is one way of describing what the Buddha taught and what the Buddha embodies. And we can exist on an archetypal level too, in a way. We can have an archetypal life, and we can do this by cultivating our imagination. The Buddha, the Dharma says again and again, the Pali Canon texts say again and again, the Buddha is beyond the scope of reason. There's this word in Pali, attakavachara, and it means beyond the scope of reason. You can't grasp and pin down the Buddha with the rational mind. The Buddha's bigger than the rational mind. But we can meet the Buddha with our imagination. Our imagination can be bigger than the rational mind. And meeting the Buddha in our imagination can have a profound karmic effect. The law of karma says actions have consequences, and they're actions of body, speech and mind. So if we're able to cultivate in our heart-mind the capacity for imagination and to meet the Buddha there, that can have a profoundly transforming effect. And I'll say more about this later. But I wanted to say a bit more about imagination itself. I think it's fair to say that imagination gets quite a bad press, really. It's often belittled. It's often muddled up with fantasy and fancy. People say, oh, it's just imagination. It's only a dream. With the implication that it's less real than the physical, material world. But we imagine all the time. In fact, a lot of Buddhist practice is aiming to show us that we're using our reactive imagination in a way that actually causes us quite a lot of harm. We imagine things all the time that aren't actually happening and aren't actually going to happen, but we're able to bring them to mind so vividly that actually they have an effect on us. That's a karmic consequence. So a lot of mindfulness practice is really encouraging us to notice when we've let our minds imagine reactively and harmfully. But it's also possible to cultivate our minds so that our imagination can function in a way which is creative, not reactive, that can actually help us to pursue, to make a connection with, to dwell on something positive. I mean, we do this in the Metta Bhavana, don't we? When we bring people to mind, very often one of the most effective ways of doing that is by imagining a person, imagining a scene, imagining a connection or a conversation. And that has an effect. And we have this colloquial phrase, don't we? We talk about our imagination being captured. It captured my imagination. How often do we say that? Oh, that really captured my imagination. And as I've said before, some of you would have heard me say this before, but I think it's really true to say that our imagination is not just captured sometimes, it's actually held hostage. If we're not mindful of how we use our imagination, it can be captured by all sorts of things that lead us into pain and suffering. Anxiety, you could say, is a fruit of an imagination that's been captured. Consumerism, when we're so intent on whatever it is we feel we need to acquire in order to be happy. Xenophobia, that sort of fear of the foreign, fear of the unknown, is such a governing force in our world today. That's imagination, it's fearful imagination. Addictions can sometimes start with imagination, they become physical as well. But it's like imagination can be captured. Imagination is very, very powerful. Very powerful. Actually, my friend Daria Vachin, who's from Venezuela, was saying to me a few months ago when I was in Nottingham, we were having an evening on Blake, and he was saying there is a word in the Spanish language for kind of political imagination. I can't remember, it's a word that's used in politics, but it's like really recognising that politicians can really get hold of and use imagination, but they actually name it. There's a word in Spanish that names this. So we're talking about something very weighty, in fact. And Sangharakshita, our teacher who founded our Buddhist movement, encouraged us to think of imagination as a faculty. As a faculty. So what do I mean by faculty? Well, you could think of it in a way, it's like you've got a thinking faculty, you've got a feeling faculty, you've got a sensing faculty, but we've also got this other faculty, which is imagination. And it's something that can be cultivated. And I think it's so important that we really recognise this, because if we deny the effect of the imagination. In a way, it's like we're turning our backs on one of the most profoundly effective means of transformation that we have. And as I say, it's a way of connecting back across thousands of years with the Buddha. A few years ago, an important paper emerged in our community that really explored the role of imagination. It's called Reimagining the Buddha. And in it, Sangharakshita says, if we don't find a connection with the Buddha in our own imaginations, if we don't find the Buddha in our own imaginations, our real faith will remain in the material world. It's like actually a lot of the time we've just been conditioned to have faith that what is material is what is most real. But in our Dharma practice, we start to realise that so much of that, all of that, is impermanent, insubstantial and unsatisfactory. The Buddha is none of those things. So can we make a heart connection, an imagination connection with the Buddha? The Buddha isn't impermanent, he's not insubstantial, and he's not unsatisfactory. And the way that that can happen is an integral part of our going for refuge to the three jewels, going for refuge to the Buddha. So he goes on to say, when one goes for refuge to the three jewels, there must be some felt sense of the Buddha and his enlightened experience within one's own imagination. So you've got some kind of felt sense of that. But it's not the same for everyone. For some, this will be quite clear and definite, perhaps connected with a very particular visionary or visual image. But for others, it might be much more inchoate, so that means sort of vague, undefined. Perhaps it's an atmosphere or a felt sense of the nature of a Buddha's awareness. Some will feel it as a growing presence in their lives, as if there were a consciousness greater than their own encompassing and even communicating with them. And I certainly have friends who experience this, and I think at times I myself have that sense of present, the presence of a kind of awareness which speaks to me of the Buddha. It's different for different people. We have to be honest about what our own experience is. And something I'd say at this point is sometimes we can get into quite a lot of inverted pride. So like pride that's turned the wrong way up. And people go, oh me, no, I haven't got an imagination. I haven't got an imagination at all. No. That isn't true. It's just not true. We all imagine all the time. Anytime we've wanted a relationship, a holiday, a job, a course of study, a new car, a kitchen, whatever it is, to some extent we've imagined that on some level. We've had some image, some vision of something that we've moved towards. So if we want to be free of suffering like the Buddha, it can really help to have him live in our imagination in some way as a living presence. As I say, Sangharakshita has suggested that we can think of imagination as a faculty that we can cultivate. So it's not that we've either got it or not. It's that there might be some, in all of us, there is that capacity to imagine. And it can grow. And it can grow in dependence on conditions, like everything. So if you think of it as being, could be like, as I said, a seed. Earlier I mentioned it might be like a seed or a spark or something calling you. And it needs us to respond. It won't do anything if we're passive in response to it. The spiritual life is the active life. And that means responding. Whether it's a spark, whether it's a call, whether it's that sense of a seed in us that wants to grow. If it's a seed, it needs watering. If it's a spark, it needs oxygen to really turn into flames, the flames of transformation. And if it's a call, well, that call needs answering. Call and response. We do it again and again in our Buddhist practice. It happens on many levels. It happens on a literal level, as when we chanted the refuges and precepts. That was call and response. But it also has happened to all of us who are sitting here We're sitting here for a reason. We've responded to something. However you characterise that, you could think of it as there was a call and you've responded. And however that comes about, that call, that seed, that spark, it needs space. It needs attention. It needs kindly attention. It needs metta. It needs positive regard, however it presents itself. Because I think one of the things is we can sometimes think, oh, it's got to look like this, and it will be really heavenly and blissful and enjoyable and have some image of what the experience might be. And it might not be like that at all. It might shock you. It might embarrass you. You might be really surprised at the strength of your response, either towards or against the Buddha or some aspect of the Dharma that you come across. You might feel, oh, it's my response is so weak, I'm not going to pay any attention. Doesn't mean there's not a response, it just means that it hasn't grown yet. You might experience a strong sense of love or passion. It might be anger that comes up for you. There's a whole Buddhist path to be trodden using all that energy of anger. There's a whole aspect of the archetypal realm populated by figures that embody that energy of anger. Confusion. Might be that our response is confusion. Can we meet that kindly? Can we be curious? Can we really have a sense of, oh, I can sit with this and see what wants to emerge from the confusion? And it might be fear. We can have all these responses to the Buddha. It's all energy which can be used and transformed. It can be transformed by meditation, it can be transformed by reflection, by the practice of patience, by many, many different aspects of Buddhist practice. That's something you could explore later on in your groups if you want. So back in 2007, I was fortunate enough to go on a 3-month retreat in the mountains in Spain. And it can be quite challenging being on a 3-month retreat with the same 21 people for 3 months, with no contact at all with the outside world, lots of silence, lots of time to be in touch with your own experience, your own demons and maras, as well as the highs and the joys and the delights. But there was one particular night when I was awake in the night and I was really wrestling with, it was something to do with contentment. Why can't I be content? Here I am on this retreat, got all these conditions that I've wanted for so long and I wasn't happy. And then from somewhere this line came to me: even if we can't see it, we bow down in our own perfection. The world is this mirror, our constant retelling of the image before us. Time only serves the lament of the world. There can be no shadow without the lust for shadow. Fire placed on the highest ground, a golden thread of sympathy connecting us through all darkness. Surely this is reason enough to smile. Trust in the goal. Let things happen as they should. Even if we can't see it, we bow down in our own perfection. The world is this mirror, our constant retelling of the image before us. Time only serves the lament of the world. There can be no shadow without the lust for shadow. Fire placed on the highest ground, a golden thread of sympathy connecting us through all darkness. Surely this is reason enough to smile. Trust in the goal. Let things happen as they should. And I woke up in the morning and I was like, what's that? Where's that from? And I was hunting around. I thought, it's a sutra. It must be a sutra. Where is it? And I hunted and I looked and I went into the library and eventually I half remembered, I must have half remembered, and I found it was a poem by my friend Manjushra. the one I mentioned earlier. And it's actually his poem called Ghazal Buddha. Ghazal is a Persian form of poetry. And he used to recite it often. And it was like it came to me when I needed it in the night. It was a kind of, it felt like a sense in which something of the Buddha came to me, mediated by him. Again, it was a sense of that poem had somehow stuck. I hadn't sat down and learned it. It was like it somehow stuck, and then when I needed it, it sort of started to emerge. But learning things by heart, having things in your heart, is a great way to water the imagination. So in that, we've got this image of the mirror. The world is this mirror. And we can also think of the Buddha as a mirror. A mirror that reflects back to us who we are and how we are when we come into relationship with him. When we come into the shrine room, or if we're sitting at home and we bring the Buddha to mind. It's like, oh, okay, how do I find myself in relation to that image? Again, we're looking at call and response. There's a friend of Badra's and mine in London who's been in the order for a very, very long time, and I remember having a lovely conversation with him quite a long time ago about this. He spent a lot of time exploring call and response, and he works as a psychotherapist, and he's very used to the whole spectrum of human emotion, and I really love the fact he's very down to earth. And you remember him saying, some days you go in the shrine room and the last thing you want to do is bow to the bloody thing. And I was in some ways shocked, but also, oh yes, yeah, in some way, some days the last thing you want to do is bow to the Buddha. And it's like, oh, what's that about? That's interesting. That's interesting, because that isn't the experience. It's not my experience all the time. Sometimes it's my experience, sometimes... whoa, like I say, sometimes it's just too challenging or too, oh, not today. Noticing honestly what our response is. It can be a mirror. It can be a mirror. And we can respond with curiosity or we can respond with ignorance. Very interesting to reflect that ignorance and ignorance have a connection. But ultimately, the Buddha is beyond the grasp of reason. This word, Atthakavachara, beyond the grasp of reason. He's the embodiment of the Dharma. And there's that lovely verse from the Diamond Sutra that sums this up. I'm just wondering whether to sing it or say it. I think I'm going to risk trying to sing it, but if it goes wrong, because of my voice, I'll say it. Those who by my form did see me, those who followed me by voice from the effort they engaged in, me those people will not see. From the Dharma should one see the Buddhas, from Dharma bodies comes a guidance, so should we see. Yet Dharma's true nature cannot be discerned, and no one can be conscious of it as an object. Those who by my form did see me, and those who followed me by voice, wrong the efforts they engaged in. Me, those people will not see. From the Dharma should one see the Buddhas. From Dharma bodies comes their guidance. Yet Dharma's true nature cannot be discerned, and no one can be conscious of it as an object. So I wanted to end by connecting us back with some of the points that Taranisha made in the last 2 weeks, when we've been looking at 20 ways of dealing with overwhelm, these points from Visantra. Because the very last of those 20 points was about reflecting on shunyata, emptiness, the emptiness of reality. And the Buddha is the embodiment of that very emptiness. In a way, that's what that verse from the Diamond Sutra is saying. The Buddha's ungraspable, he can't be pinned down, he's the trackless one. By what path can you lead the Buddha astray? He who can follow the pathless ways of the infinite. Ultimately, the Buddha is shunyata, the embodiment of shunyata, the open dimension of being. We can't grasp the Buddha, but we can become attuned to the Buddha. We can meet him in our imagination. And in my experience, that can really help us to deal with overwhelm, with the state of the world, to awaken our hearts in the suffering world. And there were a few more of the points that Taranisha made that are very directly relevant in a few more of these 20 points that weave right back in with what we've been talking about this evening with the Buddha. So the second point was, do whatever you need to do to stay resourced. And one way to do this is to draw on inspiration, like the Buddha. Like I say often in the morning, those verses that I recited at the start, I tune in with those as a ground base in a way for meditation. It's a way of resourcing. And the fourth point was, make sure that you stay well grounded. Don't forget meditation. So you can think of connecting with the Buddha as being a kind of earth touching, which you can do at any time, which the Buddha himself did, you know, on the eve of his enlightenment, when doubt really assailed the Buddha in the form of Mara. He touched the earth. He touched the ground. And we can do that by connecting with the Buddha ourselves, if that speaks to us. The ninth point, I took notes, you probably noticed. The ninth point, work in the sphere of your influence. So that's saying we've all got a sphere of concern, which might be as wide as the whole world, but we've actually got a much smaller sphere of influence. And actually, our internal world is what we can have the biggest influence on. Our imagination is part of that. So that's part of working within our sphere of influence. We can use our imagination within our sphere of influence. And particularly, again, this is the 11th point, work on the inner as well as the outer level. And imagination has a huge effect on our inner world, as I said earlier. You know, we're reactive, we have reactive imagination, we put ourselves in hell. We have creative imagination, we can really, really change that. Point number 12, entrust the situation to deeper forces. It's a way of describing other power. We can use imagination to be receptive to something more than just ourselves, just the material world. Just something more than just a limited, rational understanding of things. Again, that's bringing in that open dimension. There's more, there's something more that's possible. And finally, the one I wanted to mention was point number 18. I particularly like this one. Use short pieces of Dharma to help to anchor you. So those verses from the Dharmapada are a really good example of that. He is calm like the earth that endures. He is steady like a column that is firm. He is pure like a lake that is clear. Might not do it for you. Something else will. We're all different. We all have to find what sparks us, what calls to us. But it's important that we do that. So in a way, with those lines, it brings us back to the beginning. So yeah, imagination is a faculty, and it's far more powerful than most of us realise. We've all got it, and we're all using it all the time, whether we like it or not. It's really a question of become aware of it and use it, or be used by it. Our imagination will run riot and have a field day on its own if we don't bring mindfulness, bring awareness to what we're doing with our imagination. And we can use it to connect with the Buddha, to meet the Buddha. we can learn to use it creatively, not only to benefit ourselves, but also to benefit others, to the extent that we can be grounded, we can be free, like the Buddha, or we're in a much better space to awaken our hearts in a suffering world.